Good morning. A ceasefire in Gaza is expected to begin today after 2 years of war that has destroyed the territory and taken so many lives. A hostage exchange is part of the deal, but will this lead to a permanent end of the violence? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Five 500 National Guard troops are outside Chicago, including hundreds brought in from Texas. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. President Trump calls the city dangerous, but Chicago had the lowest numbers of homicides this summer since the 1960s. Also, the Trump administration is considering a $10 billion bailout for soybean farmers after China stopped buying any of their crops in favor of Brazil's. What do farmers want Trump to do about the trade war? It's Thursday, October 9th. On this day in 2004, Afghans held presidential elections for the first time. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says Israel and Hamas have agreed on the first phase of his peace proposal. Trump is likely to travel to the region soon, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
In a message on Truth Social, President Trump announced a deal on the first phase of his peace plan. That means all of the remaining hostages will be released very soon, he writes, and Israel will withdraw troops to an agreed-upon line. Mediators say aid will be allowed to enter Gaza. Trump told reporters earlier in the day that he could travel to the region this weekend.
I'll be going to Egypt, most likely. That's where everybody is gathered right now, and we appreciate that very much. But I'll be making the rounds, as the expression goes. I probably will.
He didn't rule out visiting Gaza when he was asked. A group representing families of the remaining hostages thanked Trump for what they're calling this historic breakthrough. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge hears arguments today on the legality of President Trump's deployment of National Guard troops in Illinois. Trump says he's doing this to stop crime in Chicago. The National Guard troops are outside the city because Illinois officials don't want them there. But federal immigration agents have been sent to a Chicago suburb. From member station WBEZ, Mike Puente has more.
There have been vastly conflicting stories on what's been happening with arrests by ICE, with the Trump administration calling protesters rioters and protesters objecting to arrests. Some of the protests at the ICE facilities in another suburban area have flared into violence, with protesters videotaping incidents, which shows ICE escalating the violence as they're shooting rubber bullets into the crowds and spraying them with pepper spray.
Mike Puente reporting. A new poll finds differences between people about what health information they believe and from whom they hear the information. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports the study showed that differences are falling along political party lines.
President Trump warned pregnant women last month against taking acetaminophen, the ingredient in Tylenol, claiming it causes autism. Doctors say there's no causal evidence for that and say taking Tylenol is safer than a fever in pregnancy. So what's the public reaction? The poll by KFF found nearly 60% of Democrats say the president's statements were definitely false, but an almost equal percentage of Republicans believe the opposite. Ashley Kurzinger directed the poll for KFF, a health policy research organization.
As people are going to different sources of information to make decisions around their health care, we're going to see partisanship playing a big role in what people decide to do.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
On Wall Street in pre-market trading, stock futures are flat. This is NPR. The Senate has rejected a measure intended to block President Trump's deadly attacks against alleged drug smugglers in the Caribbean Sea. The vote was mostly along party lines. Trump's initial strikes have been on vessels from Venezuela. Now, the president of Colombia says the latest strike was on people from his country. John Otis reports on the widening U.S. attacks.
U.S. officials say American airstrikes in the Caribbean have destroyed 4 drug smuggling boats from Venezuela and killed 21 people. The legality of these military attacks remains unclear, and now Colombia has been drawn into the conflict. Colombian President Gustavo Petro said on social media that the U.S. destroyed a boat carrying Colombian citizens and that a, quote, new war scenario had opened up in the Caribbean. The White House called Petro's statement baseless and reprehensible. For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
Former FBI Director James Comey will go on trial January 5th. He's pleaded not guilty to federal criminal charges of lying to Congress. President Trump had demanded that the Justice Department go after Comey, and days later, the agency complied. Authorities have arrested and charged a 29-year-old Florida man with starting the deadly Palisades fire in the Los Angeles area last January. 12 people were killed. Thousands of structures were destroyed. Officials allege Jonathan Rindernecht started a fire on New Year's Day, and it later burst into the huge wildfire. A second L.A. area fire killed 19 people. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
The fans, on the whole, were decent kids who camped outside the Dakota on New York's Central Park in the ecstatic hope of catching a glimpse of the apartment's most celebrated occupant, John Lennon. The ex-Beatle and the songwriter behind Imagine was a constant fixture around there, coming and going at all hours to restaurants or on walks with his wife and son. By 1978, Lennon was firmly entrenched in his house husband phase, not doing much music-wise, but the fans still turned up to get a photo or an album signed. That year, a striking blonde girl joined the ranks outside the Dakota. Lennon spotted the girl and asked her name, Brenda Spencer. You've got an accent, Lennon said. Where are you from? Minnesota. So from then on, he'd hail his country girl or the girl from miles away. The last time blonde Brenda from Minnesota and her idol met was April 9th, 1980, when they posed for a photograph. By the end of that year, John Lennon would put out his first album in 5 years with the single, Just Like Starting Over. And I, shot to death outside the Dakota.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in New York City. Good morning. After 2 years and 2 days, Israel and Hamas have agreed to a ceasefire in Gaza. But unlike in the past, President Trump says this plan is for a permanent end to the war. He says in this first phase of the deal, Israel will pull back its troops, though not fully withdraw from Gaza. For more on this, we're joined by NPR's international correspondents Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv and Aya Batraoui in Dubai, who have been covering all of this for these 2 years and 2 days. Good morning to you both.
Thank you, Leila.
Good morning.
So, Daniel, I want to start with you. When does the ceasefire begin, and when are people freed on both sides?
The ceasefire has not yet gone into effect. A person briefed by Egyptian officials close to the talks, who was not authorized to speak publicly, tells us that the plan is the following. The ceasefire is expected to take place, take effect at the end of today. Then Israel will begin pulling back its troops from parts of Gaza Friday. On Saturday, Hamas will start retrieving hostages. And President Trump is expected to make a trip to the region on Sunday. And then by Monday, Israel will allow hundreds of aid trucks into Gaza, bringing food and desperately needed supplies. And also by Monday, Hamas is expected to begin releasing the 20 living hostages, and Israel will begin releasing about 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees, including women and children. It is expected to take much longer for everyone to recover the bodies of 28 dead hostages. Some are under rubble in Gaza.
Aya, what's the reaction been in Gaza among Palestinians to this deal?
There was some sporadic celebration, but it's mostly been muted. I mean, look, Leila, you know, people have been living a nightmare in Gaza for 2 years, and it's not over. It's not something that you just wake up from overnight. Have a listen to Ahmed Aid, a father in Gaza, who told NPR it's way too soon for him to celebrate.
وين نفرح؟ أنا قاعد في خيمة، أنا أولادي مشططين ومشردين.
Saeed says, what exactly should I be happy for with all the bloodshed and martyrs? He says he's been living in a tent with his children, displaced from his home, that he's lost 150 family members in Israeli attacks in this war, and that the people around him, also in tents, don't have any food or water. It's hard to capture the scale of loss in Gaza. You know, the health ministry there says 67,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks in this war. 20,000 of those are children. And the UN says another 1,000 children have lost limbs. Most homes are destroyed, and it will take years to sift through that rubble where there are thousands of tons of unexploded bombs and bodies buried under that rubble.
Wow, so much to deal with in the future. Daniel, what are the reactions from Israeli families who have loved ones still held hostage in Gaza?
Well, this morning at Hostage Square, as it's known in Tel Aviv, where the families of the hostages have gathered for 2 years, rallying to end the war and to release their loved ones, this morning they were cheering and singing. But despite that sense of hope and excitement, we also heard mixed feelings from the crowd. We spoke to one man named Rotem Cooper, who called it subdued happiness. His dad, Amiram Cooper, was taken hostage to Gaza in the Hamas-led October 7th attack 2 years ago. He survived a long time in captivity in Gaza, but he died there. So he's hoping for his dad's body to be returned in this deal. And he actually blames Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He said, torpedoed deals on the table throughout the war that could have freed his father alive. And his only praise this morning was for Trump.
It's President Trump. It didn't happen because of something the Israeli government did or the prime minister. It's happened despite what the prime minister did.
And what the prime minister did was last month he ordered a strike on Hamas's negotiators in Qatar. It failed to kill them. And analysts say that that actually was the moment that led to where we are today. It helped President Trump get Arab countries on board with a peace plan. And analysts say Trump is now the one who will need to guarantee this is a success moving forward.
Now, you two have been covering this war, as I said, for the entire time. How would you summarize this moment? Daniel?
I would say that each side comes out with something in its hands, but also significantly weakened. Israel gets hostages back. It has had military victories over the past 2 years, knocking down its enemies throughout the region, but it is more globally isolated than ever before. And Hamas has survived, but for now. It has lost Gaza. It is dramatically weakened. We will have to see in the next phases of this deal just how sidelined it is. But I just want to underscore just the feeling here that it's history, and it's very emotional, a very emotional day here.
Yeah, of course. Aya, what about you?
Well, Layla, to me, this moment is really about the cost of this war. Of course, Trump, Netanyahu, and Hamas want to paint this as a moment of victory for themselves, but the rubble and the ash of Gaza that everyone is emerging from, to me, tells a different story. This war was live streamed for the past 2 years on all of our social media feeds. Yeah. Hundreds of thousands of Israeli reservists fought in this war. The entire population of Gaza has been affected. They've lost the lives that they once had and their hope. And so what this could mean is actually a generation of people across the region who don't believe in peace. And that is something the region will have to reckon with.
Wow, a generation of people who don't believe in peace. International correspondents Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv and Aya Batraoui in Dubai, thank you to you both for your reporting.
Thank you, Layla.
You're welcome.
This moment is especially personal for the families who have been waiting for 2 years for their loved ones to come home. One of them is Uri Goren, cousin of Tal Haimi, whose remains are still being held in Gaza. Uri, so the ceasefire is in effect at the end of today. We just heard Daniel Estrin report that. And Saturday, Hamas starts retrieving hostages. But when you heard for the first time that an agreement had been reached, what was going through your mind and your heart?
I think Rotem Cooper, that we've heard earlier, said it right. You know, the first is a sigh of relief because finally this is what we've been striving for these 2 years. You know, protesting out in the streets, traveling all around the world, speaking to politicians, going here to the Israeli parliament, the demonstrations and the rallies and all we've done led to this very moment. So the first thing is a sigh of relief, but then we've got to remember exactly what the correspondence has just said. Some of the murdered hostages are being, they can't be found, or at least Hamas says they can't find them. My cousin is a murdered hostage, and we are here, we the hostage families, and all the people that support this cause, we are here until the last remaining hostage is back in Israel. We all deserve to have this closure and have them brought back.
Well, what's your understanding about Tal's remains? Are they not found? Do you know if you'll be able to get it somehow?
Unfortunately, this is not an information that is disclosed to us because, as you know, and it actually makes sense in order to not jeopardize the military and the intel's efforts to retrieve all the bodies. So all we have left is, you know, really aspire for the best. But for me, it really doesn't matter because this struggle is not about Tal. It's about all the hostages that need to be back home.
What would it mean to you, though, to have his remains back with you?
You know, there's a term we've come to learn in these past 2 years, and it's called delayed grief. You know, when you lose someone, you go through the different phases of grieving, and at first there's shock, then there's denial, and then you're supposed to move forward until you come to terms with it, and you can rebuild and move on. And we've just been stuck. We got stuck on October 7th. We don't have time to grieve. We don't even have proof that he's dead. And that just keeps all these families stuck in phase one, which normally, you know, you have to go see a therapist if you're stuck grieving in phase one. But the circumstances are such. And all of these families, all of us, we've lost family members, we've lost friends, we've lost people that we knew and never had a time to stop and grieve them. And that is the first thing that needs to happen in order for us to actually move forward.
If you could, for just a minute, can you tell us about your cousin, Tal? Who was he?
Absolutely. Tal was kind of a shy person. He's not the first person you would notice when he walked into a room, but he was always the first person people turned to when they needed something fixed or when, you know, he was a civil engineer. He was very good with his hands. So when, you know, everybody bought IKEA... I'm sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, I got you loud and clear.
Yeah,
Udi.
Yeah. When people would get IKEA furniture, then he would be the one they would call. And he was also a family man. He was really a part of his community. He would wake up early to make sandwiches for the kids. He would come back home to spend time with them. And the Chaimi clan, they're a big family in the kibbutz, and they would be together all the time, a lot of times, in Tal's home.
Now, we've been places before where deals come close and then they wind up falling apart. I know this feels like it's a done deal, but, I mean, are you worried at all that something could happen?
It really doesn't feel like a done deal.
Okay.
It would be a done deal when we would see hostages going into white ambulances in Gaza and driving home to Israel, or in our case, body bags put in white ambulances and driving to Israel. And and you're right, we've been let down before. We've been let down miserably. And it will only be a done deal when they're all home.
About 20 seconds, Udi, if you could directly speak to leaders, what would you want them to hear from you?
First of all, the first thing that needs to happen in order to move forward is bring back all 48 hostages. But after that, what Trump's plan entails is the future for this region. And I said there's an entire generation that's being traumatized by this war on both sides. And we have to make sure that all the political power and all the will and the vision and the money goes into implementing this plan because we deserve a better future.
That's Udi Goren, cousin of Tal Haimi, whose remains are still being held in Gaza. Udi, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
KEXE means a lot to people, including our member services manager, Heather Johnson.
Had a little baby. He never stopped screaming for 2 years. He has since substituted that for talking nonstop. But those first
shout out to Alex.
Yeah, shout out to Alex. Great kid, terrible baby. There was a lot of screaming, not much sleeping. So the radio was like constantly like my friend. Like, oh my gosh, thank goodness the morning show is on. And oh, now there's somebody playing great music and everything. And it was just such a relief. And then I was working from home at that point, so I wasn't going into the office and seeing adults anyway. So it was just nice to hear adult voices, you know what was going on in this new town and know what we could do, like what I could take this little screaming thing to.
We need your support now. Go to KEXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you for being a part of this community.
NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Martinez. The Trump administration is considering a $10 billion bailout for soybean farmers. China spent over $12.5 billion on American soybeans last year, but it stopped buying after Trump put high tariffs on Chinese exports. Here to tell us how that's playing out in the American soybean market, we called up a Kentucky farmer, Caleb Regland. Farms 4,000 acres of soybeans, corn, and winter wheat. He's also president of the American Soybean Association.
So, Caleb, when we last spoke with you in April, you were very concerned about what another trade war with China would do to soybean farmers here. Let's revisit what you told us when we asked you how you wanted the Trump administration to approach a trade deal with China. Let's hear that.
We want him to get the best deal possible. If that means tariffs for a short term, fine, but we can't be in a tariff war for years on end because we'll die before then.
Okay, so Caleb, the trade war with China is still ongoing. How are you doing?
We're not doing well at all as an industry. We have zero sales on the books of this new crop to the Chinese, who are our biggest export customer historically. They have been the purchasers of more export tons than all of our other foreign customers combined in recent years, and equate to about 25% of the whole U.S. crop. And right now, with them being a big zero in the purchase column, that's a five-alarm fire for our industry.
And so they are getting their soybean from somewhere else, though, right?
The main supplier has been Brazil. They have jumped in, and Brazil has passed the U.S. as the number one soy-producing country since the 2018 trade war, and they are now far ahead of us, unfortunately, in terms of production acres and in production tons.
I remember back in Trump's first term, American soybean farmers got $22 billion in aid, which was to soften the blow of Trump's trade war with China. Was that helpful back then? I know you'd probably rather have trade than aid, but was that helpful back then?
It softens the blow, but it doesn't make us whole. It never shows up in time before the pain has already been felt. It'll take care of part of the problem, but it never makes it complete. Yeah. And it certainly never makes farmers profitable.
Do soybean farmers want a $10 billion government bailout?
You know, what soybean farmers want more than anything is good opportunities within the market to be able to make a profit. Sometimes these short-term economic assistance packages and so forth are necessary when the government is unable to get out of its own way and has trade wars and things that cause roadblocks within that free market system, within that market-based approach. And unfortunately, that is the crossroads that we are at as an industry right now.
Caleb, you voted for Trump 3 times. What's the message you want to send to the administration right now?
The message that I have for President Trump and the administration is we need opportunities from the market, and tariffs and trade wars, they take away opportunity. We put tariffs on China. They have retaliated with 20% tariffs on our soybeans. That makes us uncompetitive compared to the Brazilian beans. When we have a level playing field, the American farmer wins. We are the best producers in the world. We have the best quality products. The market wants our products, but we also have to be in the ballpark on the price side. And that is where we're out of bounds right now. My challenge for the administration is to create a level playing field. Don't build barriers with tariffs and with trade wars, and give us the opportunity to win, and we will.
Caleb Ragland is a Kentucky farmer and president of the American Soybean Association. Caleb, thank you.
Thank you, A.
A popular national park completely reopened this week despite the government shutdown. Great Smoky Mountains National Park on the North Carolina-Tennessee border. Local governments came up with nearly $2 million to keep it fully staffed. As Pierce Gentry with member station WUOT reports, this is the height of the region's fall tourism season.
The gates are open again at the entrance of Cades Cove, the most popular scenic drive in Great Smoky Mountains National Park. It attracts a constant stream of cars packed with eager leaf watchers. Ray Nelson marvels at the dark reds, deep browns, yellows, and specks of green.
We came down here expecting it to be not quite as advanced.
Nelson is visiting from upstate New York. He's glad the park is open.
When there's a big tragedy, people step up, and I think that's just fine.
Some of the most popular parts of the park were closed for the first 3 days of the shutdown, but 7 local governments, including townships, tribes, and the state of Tennessee, are now paying most of the Smokies' 275 full-time employees. Sevier County, which touts itself as the gateway to the Smoky Mountains, is fronting much of the money. Here's Vice Mayor Brian McCarter.
If that place is not open, yeah, there's still things here for people to do, but the perception amongst a lot of folks is, well, then Sevier County must be closed. And so we have to make sure that that opens to drive that economy.
The shutdown came at a bad time for this region. It's still recovering from damage dealt by Hurricane Helene last year. McCarter says tourism is down about 10% already in an area that relies on traffic to the mountains for income.
And having the national park open that quickly was a big, big boost, I think, here locally for our tourism.
In the woods outside Cades Cove is Jim Matheny, a spokesperson for the nonprofit Friends of the Smokies. They also put up some money to keep the staff paid. He says visiting a national park with no rangers is like visiting Disney World without Mickey Mouse.
Because even if you had places that you could get to, there's a big difference between it being accessible and being fully staffed.
Around the country, some parks remain open without staff in key places. Others are completely closed. Those who are paying the staff at Great Smoky Mountains National Park say they can keep this up for a month and hope to get their money back when the federal government restarts. For NPR News, I'm Pierce Gentry in the Smoky Mountains.
The Smoky Mountains is the place to put a big smile on your face. The trees are yellow, red, and green. It's the prettiest place I've ever seen.
This is NPR News.
Jennifer Lopez has always dreamed of being in a musical, and now that dream has come true.
These roles like this for me and for people like me don't come around every day.
I'm Elsa Chang. We talked to Jennifer Lopez about finally starring in her first musical ever, Kiss of the Spider-Woman, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And if you find that you land in jail, a little fantasy will not fail. It's just as simple as ABC.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon here on People Powered KAXC. Your local host will be Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 5:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in on this Thursday morning. Coming up in a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date.
Weather for today, increasing clouds, highs 62 to 66, winds from the south 10 to 15. Our lows tonight, 44 to 50. And for tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 60s, breezy north winds. And for Saturday, sunny again with highs in the low to mid 60s. The Minnesota DNR and Minnesota Forestry Association will host a series of webinars for landowners in response to summer storm damage in the Bemidji area. The first webinar is 4 o'clock this Monday, October 13th. It's about common tree pests and diseases. There will be two more webinars the second Monday of November and December. Learn more and register at minnesotaforestry.org/blowdown. It's Pumpkin Fest in downtown Aurora this Saturday from 10 to 3. Enjoy crafts, a costume contest, wagon rides, live music, and more. Find a full schedule at celebrateaurora.com. And Trinity Lutheran Church on Highway 71 in Lake George has a lutefisk supper this Saturday from 4 to 7:30. They will also serve lefse, Swedish meatballs, pie, and more. You can let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. There will be an Indigenous People Celebration on Monday, October 13th from 4:30 to 7 at the Gitche Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd. See the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Color Guard, a student hand drum group, and the exhibit, Why Treaties Matter.
On today's date, October 9th, 1999, I spot a monarch with an injured wing. It's headed south, but whether it'll make it to Mexico or not remains a question. This is not the latest monarch that I've ever seen or had reported to me. My mother saw a monarch on the 29th of October in the same year, 1999. Prior to that, I had a monarch sighted on the 27th of October in 1990 by Brad Nett. And before that, the 27th in 2014. And other late dates would have been the 23rd in 2004. Jeff Sipper saw that one in Brainerd. October 21st in 2011 and 2001, both Harry Hutchins and Mary Nett saw monarchs that late. So it's not entirely out of the question to see monarchs later in the month of October. There are always some who are the last to leave the country. As I said earlier, that doesn't mean that they'll make it to Mexico. It just means that they were slow to leave Minnesota.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Faldil in New York City. Hundreds of National Guard troops are staging outside of Chicago under orders from President Trump.
It's in response to recent protests against immigration and customs enforcement operations in Chicago. Trump has said the city is a war zone, and now the president is calling for the arrest of Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson.
NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran joins me now from Chicago. Good morning, Sergio.
Good morning, Leila.
I mean, it's pretty unprecedented to hear a U.S. president call for the arrest of a duly elected city mayor and state governor. Mm-hmm. What is he saying about why?
I mean, President Trump says they should be arrested for, quote, failing to protect ICE officers, but it's unclear what actions he's actually referring to. Now, Mayor Johnson says he is protecting the residents of Chicago and that he will fight the Trump administration over this National Guard deployment. I sat down with Mayor Johnson yesterday, and this is what he told me about being threatened with jail time.
This is not the first time Trump has accused or insisted on a black man being arrested. A president that is threatening to jail his political opponents is a clear yet another example of authoritarianism.
And Johnson is also pushing back on Trump's claims that Chicago is a dangerous city or a war zone. This summer, Chicago has had the lowest number of homicides since the 1960s.
And that's something that Trump has not acknowledged. Now, the National Guard have been in Chicago before. Under what circumstances were they deployed before?
Most recently during the protests after the police killing of George Floyd in 2020. And it's always been at the request of state officials. This time is different, though. They don't want it here. And that's why the anger, frustration, and at times despair of residents is so palpable here. Last night, hundreds of people peacefully marched in downtown Chicago, protesting the deployment of the troops. And the folks we've talked to here, Leila, like Eric Harvey, a construction worker, do not want ICE agents around, and they certainly do not want the National Guard patrolling the streets.
That's a publicity stunt, man. That's just some stuff he's doing so that people can say, oh, Trump is doing this about immigration. You snatching kids and people that get up and go to work every day. That's who you grab. You're not grabbing no criminals.
Harvey lives in a neighborhood that recently saw a big ICE raid at a residential building. He and other residents we talked to in this area say the Chicago Police Department is doing its job and that they don't see how the National Guard or ICE can make the city safer.
And what about immigrants in Chicago? What are they telling you?
For immigrants, this is terrifying. About 1 in 5 residents in Chicago are foreign-born, according to the census. So this has been a city where immigrants have created a community and have contributed to it big time. But now they feel unsafe.
Y ahora con la Guardia Nacional, bueno, va a estar un poco más difícil.
Jackson is a Venezuelan migrant who says he feels even more scared with the National Guard around. He's worried about being detained by immigration enforcement. That's why we're only using his first name. Now, Jackson has 3 kids and a wife, and he says they're even afraid of leaving the house to buy food. And he has not been able to work lately because of the presence of federal enforcement agencies in the city. Now, Leila, there is still a possibility that the troops are legally blocked from being deployed into Chicago. A federal court later today will hear and perhaps decide whether Trump can do this or not. Meanwhile, in a different courtroom, but at the same time, a panel of judges will hear whether the National Guard will be allowed into Portland.
That's NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For more on the expected deployment of National Guard troops to Chicago, we've called up Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley. He represents Illinois' 5th District, which includes parts of Chicago. Congressman, 500 National Guard troops could be on the streets of Chicago today. How's the city preparing?
Yeah, that's what we're anticipating. And what we've done in the last week is crisscross the city and talk to people at food shelters, at food pantries and shelters, the domestic violence courthouse, small businesses. And we've learned that attendance at these shelters, at the pantries, is really down because people are afraid to go get food. They're afraid to get shelter. They're canceling doctor's appointments because they're afraid to get scooped. Women are afraid to go to a domestic violence courthouse to get orders of protection because they're afraid someone will be there to grab them. And then finally, we're hearing from businesses that, especially in Pilsen and Little Village, that they're really hurting. They've lost workers, and a lot of people are afraid to go into the establishments for, again, afraid of being grabbed by ICE.
I know the state of Illinois is suing the administration, seeking to block this deployment of troops in Chicago. What more could leaders do to limit the presence of ICE in their city? I mean, is this the only way going through the courts?
At this point in time, the most effective way, we have our vote and we have our voice. We're locked out of D.C. virtually. We're not in session. So what we can do is tell people what's happening. My office has created an immigration protection kit, making sure people have completed privacy release forms so that our staff can assist them. We also, can find information about finding friends and family who might have been detained. So there's a number of things our office is doing to try to help people ahead of time, but also to make the public aware of what's taking place, what it means to them, and why they should oppose this.
Yeah, the rhetoric has been pretty intense. President Trump posted that Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, quote, should be in jail. The governor is encouraging Chicago residents to protest immigration enforcement. Do you endorse that protesting in Chicago?
I always endorse peaceful protesting. Okay. Now's the time to step up and let people know just how serious this has gotten. This is a president who has weaponized the tools of democracy. I think people fail to recognize the fact that Putin and Viktor Orban have shown us leaders can be elected democratically and then use the tools of democracy to try to bring that democracy down. In this case, the president's weaponizing the Justice Department to go after his perceived enemies, the FCC, and of course now the Department of Defense. Who imagined that an American president would tell a gathering of generals that American cities should be used as training grounds for the U.S. military to fight the enemy from within? I'm not sure who they are exactly referring to as the enemy from within, but we can pretty much guess it's people with brown skin.
The president has also said that he might invoke the Insurrection Act as a way to circumvent court rulings blocking him from deploying the Guard to U.S. cities such as Chicago. Just 20 seconds, Congressman, how seriously do you take that suggestion?
I think when a tyrant tells you they're going to do something, you should take it seriously. I don't think this president has any qualms about doing. I think he feels untethered from the facts and the law.
That is Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It's 5:42. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Thursday morning show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:20, our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. And coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, Heidi Holton and Kari Hedlund will be talking to two authors. At 8:10, Steve Grove from the Minnesota Star Tribune. He'll talk about his new memoir about reinventing himself in the Midwest. And then at 8:40, New York Times bestselling author Adriana Trajani about her new novel, The View from Lake Como. Do you have questions for either of these authors? If you'd like to tell us what you're reading, you can text us 218-326-1234. Also, our question of the week is all about libraries. We want to hear your stories. What was the library you went to when you were a kid like? What do libraries mean to you now? Text us 218-326-1234. We can expect increasing clouds as our day goes on. Highs today 62 to 66, south winds up to 15 miles per hour. Lows tonight 44 to 50, and tomorrow mostly sunny with highs in the low to mid 60s and breezy north winds. The Heartland Symphony Orchestra performs this Sunday, 2:30, at the Gitche Zibe Center for the Arts in Brainerd. Free will donations are accepted at the door. Find more info at heartlandsymphony.com. We'll have more ahead from Morning Edition on KAXE.
In the past, we knew more about our neighbors. I'm Heidi Holton, and KAXE provides that. We get to know the people that live in northern Minnesota, like Kathy Davies on What's for Breakfast.
Well, truly, every day I wake up with you guys, and so there's socialization. And I love the local news. That interview with Amy Klobuchar this morning was wonderful. I am so supportive of finding out what's going on with all the tribal stations and I care about the Canadian wildfires. I love to hear about everything that's local. You know, I've been to Riverfest, and that was fantastic. I listen to and support KAXE because you guys are what it's all about up here.
When you donate to KEXE, you're supporting your local community. Help us out now during this crisis of the defunding of public media from the federal government. Thank you for being there for KEXE. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. There is a new class of MacArthur Fellows. That's a collection of scholars and artists that have shown exceptional creativity and promise. Now, each of the 22 fellows will get $800,000, no strings attached, as a, quote, investment in their potential. We should note that the MacArthur Foundation is a financial supporter of NPR. Reporter Ari Daniel tells us about the only archaeologist among the winners this year.
Christina Douglas grew up all over the world, but she spent the longest stretch, about a decade, in Madagascar. In the eighth grade, she went on a class trip that involved biking nearly 400 miles along the island's remote Maswala Peninsula.
I will never understand the bravery of the teacher. But what I remember the most about that trip is getting to stop in small communities along the way.
Douglas had been told that these residents were intent on cutting down the last remnants of forest on the island, but she encountered a different reality on the ground. The people she met were part of their ecosystem, relying on local fisheries and plants.
Life there was nothing like what people were saying life there was like.
The lesson stayed with her. Later, as a PhD student at Yale, Douglas focused on how the people of Madagascar had historically interacted with their environment, including the ancient megafauna that went extinct there about 1,000 years ago.
Which included giant lemurs the size of an adult human, crocodiles, and the elephant bird.
Researchers had suggested these creatures were decimated through hunting by the people who originally settled the island, but she found the explanation lacking. So she started excavating in southwest Madagascar.
Going to the sites where people lived, ancient homes, and essentially looking through trash from their kitchens to understand if people really did hunt these animals to extinction.
Douglas and her team of local collaborators reached a different conclusion. A handful of other pressures appear to have led to the animals' demise, including reductions in habitat due to changes in climate and vegetation. Another example that the assumptions made about local communities may not be true.
In reality, indigenous communities, local communities, are some of the most important guardians and stewards of biodiversity worldwide.
Douglas later became an archaeologist at Columbia University, where she's continued studying how the Malagasy have adapted to their changing environment over time.
We're trying to identify signals in materials that people leave behind that suggest that they had links to one another.
Materials like ceramic pots fashioned from the same clay. This work, along with other research, has revealed to Douglas three key strategies that have long enabled communities in Madagascar to handle change: a diverse social network where people can lean on one another, a flexible livelihood that allows shifts between food and income streams, and mobility to move locations depending on the climate.
You want to have the biggest basket of potential strategies as possible, and the flexibility to pick what is going to work best in that particular moment, in that particular place.
Douglas admits the scale of planet-wide change today is more extreme than ever, but she says we all carry precious knowledge of how to survive change and adapt, and that includes cultural wisdom transmitted through music, movement, and communal feasts.
And I believe that if we invest more in the kinds of practices that build community, we're going to be in a much stronger place to deal with the changes that are coming.
For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
I'm Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXE to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, the history of jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music. And so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXE with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
Some of the bulbs are burned out on the Las Vegas economic indicator.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, dedicated to helping businesses save time on office tasks and empower leaders with business buying solutions that support teams to focus on growing the business. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. Turns out what happens in Vegas does not stay in Vegas. Today, a story from what is arguably the discretionary spending capital of the country to help us understand the state of the economy wherever you live. I'm just back from the neon Babylon, as some call it, where I found that the economy has lost some of its glow. On a pleasant recent evening, a few dozen, but not hundreds, of people stopped to watch the dancing fountains in front of the Bellagio Casino. Is it me, or do the jets look like a bar graph of the Las Vegas economy? Way up coming out of the pandemic through last year, but for 2025, more than a dribble, but not a mighty flow.
We love Las Vegas.
We know this because Jim here has the retro Welcome to Las Vegas sign tattooed all the way down his calf. He, Janice, and two pals have flown the 11 hours from Scotland, not for the first time.
Oh, no. Maybe 10, maybe.
So you can compare for us. Do you feel that it's a little quieter here than on
quieter
your previous trips?
Quieter and much more expensive.
There are hard data to back up the sense of quiet.
I live in a world of ones and zeros.
We had gone to see Jeremy Aguero of Applied Analysis, a research and consulting firm here.
For 30 years, we've been measuring what happens in the economy, and it's never fun when you start seeing the numbers start to slide.
Start is the key word. It's not off a cliff, but the direction is down. 7.8% fewer people came to Las Vegas in the first 8 months of this year. 1.8 million fewer humans came through the big airport here, and the regional jobless rate,
we're about 6% and edging upward. That's concerning.
Concerning beyond Las Vegas, if this is an early indicator that people are getting nervous about how they spend the money that they're not required to spend, given worries about further inflation and jobs.
Welcome to Vegas, everyone.
I saw the Scotsman's tattoo, but I'm now looking at the actual Las Vegas welcome sign where folks are taking turns doing selfies. Word is the line used to go all the way back to the parking lot, but not today, where there are maybe 15 people. Carlos brings his family in from San Diego once a year, where he says rooms that used to be $129 a night are $300.
Five of us just ate for almost $300, where before it was like $150, all of us would eat
And then his kid touched but didn't drink water in the hotel room.
We got charged $15 for a bottle of water because of the sensors on the hotel. So, I mean, not everybody comes in with $100 billion in their bank account, but at the end of the day, people come here to enjoy Vegas.
In the boom that followed the pandemic, many businesses here raised prices to take advantage of the mood to splurge. Then, after a social media backlash, prices are coming down. That said, the hotel I carefully shopped for surprised me on check-in with an extra $55 plus tax, quote, resort fee. Now, none of this surprises another visitor going for a selfie, Jermaine.
It's Vegas. If you're not coming out here to spend a little money, then you shouldn't be coming out here. But at the same time, that's a little pricey.
Local businesses also feel the pressures. Juani Romero owns seven gorgeously designed coffee shops called Mothership Coffee Roasters that use beans sourced from women-owned suppliers.
Our downtown shop, our sales are down. It's been now like about 4 to 6 months of it being down 30%. But the rest of our stores are doing really well. But just that store specifically because it's heavily tourist dependent.
The economic moment has her caught between risk and opportunity. With the downturn, she's being offered reduced rent on what could be a new mothership location on the Las Vegas Strip itself. Now, during the boom, no way she could afford that lease. Now, maybe she can, but what if the tourist slump gets worse?
The question is, how long are we going to be in this position where I don't have a crystal ball? You know, what if it's a recession? What, I mean, it would literally upend the whole company.
All that said, Las Vegas convention bookings have been holding their own this year, with dates for next year looking okay so far. Those are driven not by household budgets, but by decisions of bigger businesses during this never-say-die stock market exuberance. And there's this. A U.S. Travel Association survey just before the federal government shutdown found that 60% of travelers had said they would reconsider or cancel travel plans if a shutdown happened. It is shut down, of course, and among airports reporting some staffing shortages, Harry Reid, Las Vegas. Tomorrow, here a look at a separate challenge for Las Vegas, Trump administration border policy. Markets, S&P Dow and NASDAQ futures are little changed at the moment. This after the NASDAQ index, with many tech companies therein, closed up more than 1.1% to another all-time high yesterday. Again, the AI-driven stock market. Given the shutdown, we're still groping through the fog as far as more traditional economic indicators go. No weekly figures on state unemployment filings this morning, but tomorrow we should get an early read on October consumer sentiment, not from the closed government, but from the University of Michigan.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Now to China, which has tightened controls on the export of rare earth metals, vital parts of electronic everything, including military hardware. China already is the world's biggest player, home to much rare earth mining and refining. The BBC's Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
Foreign companies will need the Chinese government's approval to export products if they've been made using any of the country's rare earth extraction, refining, or magnet-making technology. One of the main targets of these controls appears to be overseas defense manufacturers. They'll not be granted export licenses to protect China's national security interests, according to the Commerce Ministry. Beijing appears to be trying to leverage its dominance of the supply chain as it continues trade negotiations with the US and ahead of an expected meeting between President Donald Trump and the Chinese leader Xi Jinping later this month.
That's Laura Bicker with our newsroom partners at the BBC. I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. Lots of local news stories and conversations there for you to check out. You can also click on that donate button and become one of the people who makes people-powered radio possible. Thanks so much. Weather for today, increasing clouds, highs 62 to 66, south winds up to 15 miles per hour. Lows tonight, 44 to 50, and tomorrow mostly sunny. Highs in the low to mid-60s with breezy north winds. And looking ahead to Saturday, sunny, highs in the low 60s. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has a spooktacular breakfast buffet this Sunday, 9 to noon at the Buck Lake Community Center, 12 miles north of Nashwauk. Save a buck if you wear a costume.
Good morning.